The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable tales of terror. Thank you for listening and enjoy the show. Disclaimer. Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Specifically, one of tonight's stories involves sexual assault of a teenager. Listener discretion is advised. Hello there, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm Eric Peabody, your host and narrator. Tonight, I've got two tales for you that are so damn zany that I had to double-check that this was still a horror show. But don't worry, they bring the chills as well, though you might be more focused on picking your jaw up off the floor. To start, we have I Haunted a Cult That Sacrificed Me by Richard Morgan. I suppose I don't really need to provide a synopsis for this one, since it's kind of all right there in the title. After that, we'll close out with Really Bad Dreams by Heath Pfaff, and the opening sentence of that story tells you everything you need to know about it. Brent was killed by a slice of toast fired at high velocity from an evil, sentient toaster. Folks, these are weird, ridiculous times we live in, and sometimes you need a couple of equally weird, ridiculous stories to help you get through them. So let's get absurd. You're listening to the free edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, so what are you waiting for? Also, if you're watching on YouTube or Rumble, do us a favor and drop a like and subscribe. Become part of our dark circle, listeners. And now, from author Richard Morgan, I give you I Haunted a Cult That Sacrificed Me. I was 17 when I died. Okay, I'm lying. I was 46, but I was 17 at heart. I was living like I was 17. I was still at home with my mother, still living in my room that I had since I was born into that house. I was also sponging off of her shamelessly. Dad had left behind a generous amount of money for both of us. I managed to piss all of my share away on beer and other things that weren't much better. When I had spent all of it, I found ways of spending Mama's share. It was the same tactics that had worked when I was 4 years old. The same tactics that had worked when I was 10, when I was 17. She was one of those mothers, and I was one of those sons. I had denied it up until I died. I knew I was a piece of crap, but no force on earth was going to get me to admit it. My pride and my hard head guaranteed it. Well, in my current state, pride is pointless. And I checked on my head where it got left. It's got a crack in it, so it's not as hard as it used to be. God bless my mom, but she really is as stupid as she is loving. I had been going to have a night with my guy friends, who were like me. They didn't do much after high school and sponged off their parents. Those old yearbook signatures we left for each other that said, best friends, together forever, were really quite literal, thanks to the power of alcohol and laziness. I can still see her as I had my foot in the door. She told me to look both ways before crossing the street and not to talk to strangers, just like she talked to me when I was a kid. I had done some pre-drinking, so my rebellion levels were elevated. I told her that I was going to do whatever I damn well pleased. I strode out the door to prove it. I ran blindly across the first busy street I came to, and the one after that, and the one after that. I didn't have a license, thanks to an ongoing relationship with driving under the influence. Horns honked and tires squealed, and I still managed to come to the other side yelling, "Look at me now, Ma! Look at me now!" And I knew she was at home worrying about me. Me and the guys slurred our hellos and got down to business. Business was finished at the usual time, when we got thrown out. All I could think about was how Ma had told me not to talk to strangers. So, as the three of us staggered our way to wherever, I ran up to everyone I saw and tipped my green camo ball cap and said, "How do you do?" Then I'd run off shouting something like, "Look, Ma, I'm talking to strangers!" The guys laughed, not really knowing why. I got so caught up in saying "Hey!" to every stranger in sight, and the guys got so caught up in following me, that we didn't notice that my trail was taking us away from anything familiar. There is such a thing as a beer buzz so deep that every house looks like your house, and every street looks like your street. So far as we knew, we were all close to home. Nope. We were skirting the edge of our small town, where there were acres of dark timber. My beer goggles kept me from seeing the leaves and the brush and tree trunks. I still thought I saw houses and sidewalks. And when there was an ominous figure standing in the woods wearing the severed head of a deer-like headdress with the blood flowing down his bare chest, I just saw another random person in a t-shirt and jeans. The guys didn't see the same thing. "Hey, Denny, you might want to leave that one alone," one of them said. "Shut up, idiot. You're starting to sound like my ma," I fired back. I got right in the deer's dead face. I could smell the rot. The skin was warped like the skull bone had been removed. "How do you do?" I said, tipping my hat.
"Are you a virgin?" the stranger said.
"Well, yeah, but your voice sounds right manly, so I ain't looking to..." I didn't see the sawn-off shotgun that aimed at hip level and fired at my friends. Todd's lower jaw disintegrated and some of the fragments fell down inside his shirt. Randy's ribs, all on his left side, got exposed, and I think I saw the moonlight reflecting off part of his beating heart. And Bill? Billiam, as we called him? Well, he suddenly had only one leg, and he crawled around in a tight circle, screaming like his nipple was caught in something with mechanical parts. Then he stopped moving. I managed to ask the mysterious stranger if my friends were going to heal up in time for another drink. And that's when he got me good on the forehead with the butt of that shotgun. I saw stars that danced around like real pretty fireworks. I wanted to go back to that when I woke up, but there was no going back. I was inside some rickety old church, like your great-grandma's house out in the sticks, except it's like one day she said, "Hey, let's turn this place into a church." I was by myself, and I had this horrible pain in my left shoulder. Something was poking out of it, and that weren't normal. It was some kind of meat hook. I hung like a dressed cow over a pan, apparently meant to catch any drippings. Churches gotta stay clean. I wanted to loudly articulate both the severity of my situation and my feelings about it, but all my mouth would manage were squishy, wailing vowels. Either I was still drunk or I had been drugged. Strange that the same people that would hang me on a meat hook would be nice enough to give me drugs. I was in the middle of telling the Lord that I'd start coming to church again if I could do it without the meat hook, when the crooked double doors of the church opened. Three boys entered, one of them with a pitchfork, another with a shovel, and another with a hammer. They looked exactly like the kind of boys you'd expect to be named Delmar, Floyd, and Bubba. They weren't smiling,
like they took their name seriously.
"Wa-wa-wa-wa-wa-wa-wa-wa-wa-wa-wa,"
I said, which was supposed to come out as, "Get me down off this hook, for crying out loud." Either they didn't understand, or they didn't care.
"Okay, let's tenderize him," said the tallest one.
I found out that tenderizing isn't a good thing. The one with the pitchfork tried to ram the handle up my backside, and when that didn't work, he thought that the fork end might do better. Let me tell you, it didn't. By the time I was hogtied and laying on the altar, surrounded by a bunch of hooded crazies in overalls and old-timey clothes, I was feeling grateful. The end had to be near. It had to be. A high priest of some kind in shimmering emerald robes slashed my throat, collected my blood in a chalice, took a big swig, and spat it onto the crowd in the pews. This must have been a good thing, because they all started hooting and hollering and jumping up and down. Then, death finally took me. Or had it. I found myself still laying on the altar, but I could move. I didn't hurt anymore, so there was that. Moonlight bled through the cracks in some of the stained glass. That was the only light, and yet I could see just fine. I felt my face. I didn't have night vision goggles or anything. I felt cold and somehow felt okay. I was at peace. And this bothered me. You shouldn't be feeling all right after you've been violated with both ends of a pitchfork and then volunteered as some weird cult's sacrificial lamb. Todd used to get off on some pretty crazy stuff, and even he wouldn't go through what I had been through. I went to the door, and somehow went through it. My reaction was delayed by the sight of a great bonfire just outside the church where the entire congregation was gathered. They were singing, dancing, and eating. My heart skipped a beat when I saw my own severed head on a wooden stake, the mouth hanging open as if to say something, but hesitating. Then I noticed my heart wasn't beating at all. I was dead. The full reality of it hit me. I clenched my eyes shut and I took a deep breath and I nodded. "Okay, Lord, I'm ready." I opened my eyes. The picnic was still there. I closed my eyes again, opened them again. Then I rapid-fire blinked to see if that would help. "Anytime, Lord," I said, but there was no answer and no change. I was both confused and worried. I eyed my feet warily, just in case they would start sinking into the ground, but that didn't happen either. I looked around, and my eyes were arrested by the one pair of peepers that were actually trained on me. A young guy in a t-shirt and jeans that didn't look so well. He was pale and sick. He looked dead.
"You look dead," he called out.
"I was thinking the same about you," I shot back.
"That's because I am. You must be dead too, if you can hear me."
"How's a guy supposed to get to heaven around here?"
"You can't. You're stuck. The cult's got some kind of dark mojo that holds all the spirits in."
"That's not funny," I said.
"I'm not lying. And ain't you a bit old to be a virgin sacrifice?"
"I don't know you, but we can't be friends. So long." I waved at him and left. I learned a few things about being dead. First, if you daydream, days fly by like minutes. Time is completely different. Second, you don't get tired or hungry. Getting stuck in a conversation must be hell if you can't make the excuse that it's getting late and you gotta go. Third, there is nearly no way at all to interact with the living. Nearly. My little tale here is about what nearly entails. I spent weeks just wandering around. I thought that I might hit some sort of barrier that wouldn't let me go any further, but instead I just kept ending up back at the cult's little village they had going on in the middle of the woods. North, south, east, or west, if I walked far enough, I came back to the same spot, kind of like Pac-Man. I kept seeing that same ghost from before, the kid in the shirt and jeans. You never really stop jumping at the sight of a ghost, even though you be one yourself. I kept avoiding him.
You just don't mock someone's virginity right after they die and expect them to be friendly. But he was persistent, and we eventually started shooting the breeze. His name was Eric, and he was kidnapped and murdered just as he was about to lose his virginity in the back of his cherry red Corvette. He was about to turn 20. That was over 35 years ago. Apparently, the girl he was with had lied about her virginity because she was nowhere to be found. The sun flew overhead fast, chased by the moon in a rapid race with no finish line. That's when I found out time speeds up during conversation, too. "Where's everyone else? We can't be the only two people they've ever murdered," I asked. "There's a few that are still around, but there's something about the area that dissolves ghosts, like it has a way of eating them." He saw my alarm and waved his hand, adding that it takes hundreds of years for spirits to be fully consumed. But that didn't make me feel better. I looked around at the cult's fields of grain and vegetables and the clear blue sky, and I felt as confined as Jonah in the belly of the whale. I didn't care if I had 100 years or 1,000,000. I wanted out. "What kind of people are these? How do you have a colony like this in the woods and never get busted by the police?" Eric just shrugged. "Can't tell you much about their history, man. They've got books, but nobody reads them. That's par for the course for most faiths."
"And you can't pull the books off the shelf yourself?"
"Well, I could if I waited long enough, but even that will try the patience of a ghost."
He must have seen the question in my eyes, and he gestured me to follow.
He led me to a run-down shack near the church. It was full of bookshelves, and none of them matched. Some were wooden, others metal, others plastic. "Get comfortable. We could be here a few years," he said.
"What are we looking for?"
"Just wait, okay?"
Turned out we only had to wait a few months. Something like a pucker floated through the air. I don't know what else to call it. It looked like the air was being pinched by invisible fingers into a pucker, an ethereal butthole drifting along like a feather on every subtle movement of air. Eric maneuvered himself so that the floating ghost anus was between him and one of the rows of books. He pushed his hand through the pucker and pulled a book off the shelf, but it ended up flopping onto the floor.
"It doesn't last long," he said.
"What the hell was that?" I asked.
"I have no idea, but they let you do stuff like that for a few seconds at a time. They'll also let you be heard, too, if you speak into them. They usually aren't worth the wait, though."
"What on God's green earth do you mean they aren't worth the wait? That's got to be the ticket for something."
I left Eric there, not waiting to hear what he'd have to say. I felt like an inmate that had been handed the master keys of the prison, and I had every intention of using them. I settled into the home of one of the families and made their home into my laboratory for experimenting with floating buttholes. I learned that the cultists were very much inbred. The gene pool was just deep enough to keep the kids from coming out with 3 heads. The man of the house was a goatish-looking thing named Jeb. He had his dumpy, warty wife, who was also his cousin, Edith. They had twin girls and a son that led the girls by 3 years or so. Gretchen, Bella, and Martin. I pulled objects off of shelves and tables. I yelled at people, and they heard me. But nothing happened that would help me. By the time my swell of hope fizzled out, Martin was old enough to be looking at his sisters all hungry-like. There were a lot more puckers in the air on Halloween, but not enough to get excited over. Eric had been right. The only real thing I had managed to do was spook the family I was squatting with. I got attached to the twins, something I hadn't planned on. They weren't pretty kids to look at. Both of them had large noses like sweet potatoes. Their eyes were pretty, but everything else was the stuff of trolls and ogres. They ate the congregation's victims with just as much relish as the rest of them. But I had failed at having my own family. Twin ogre kids were better than no kids at all. I would have liked Martin more if he didn't eyeball his sisters like that. The girls were just as evil as he was when it came down to it, but they were girls. It was somehow easier to ignore because of that. Bella was somehow less awful than Gretchen.
A gentleness would cross her eyes, at times, and she was the most bullied by her parents and siblings. I knew deep down that it was a case of a vicious dog being picked on by bigger vicious dogs. But I couldn't help it. The father I never got to be responded to her. I resigned myself more and more to the fate that Eric had told me about. So I thought I'd spend my remaining time on that side of oblivion next to Bella, and interacting with her however I could. Whether she was grabbing a field mouse and eating it alive, or getting kicked around by her parents, or sitting in church listening to the screams of another poor idiot that couldn't get any poontang, or just snoring gently in her bed, I was there. Eric dropped in on me after one really nasty sacrifice. I had the house to myself, as everyone was outside, around the fire, eating. I saw my Bella twisting the meat off the victim's toes, and I just couldn't do it that time. I stayed in. "You've adopted that family, huh?" "I've adopted her," I said, nodding to the linseed oil portrait of Bella that hung above the fireplace. "She'd be the runt of the litter if she weren't a twin. She's just as awful and disgusting as the rest of them. But I love her." "You shouldn't." "I know. I never got to be a dad, and kids, well, they don't ask to be born into any of this, you know. Bella didn't ask for this life, or those parents, or this religion, or any of it." "Her brother might marry her. He could marry both of them if he wanted to." I shuddered. "Why are you telling me this?" "I can just tell you're getting attached. The damned should look out for each other." "I was attached a long time ago." "So, what comes after this? Just nothing?" Eric shrugged. "It's just like the last life. We didn't know what came after that, and we don't know what comes after this. I'll leave you to your family. I just wanted to say hey." With that, he was gone. The twins hit 13, and they grew these awful misshapen breasts that their brother couldn't take his eyes off of. I sat by Bella's bedside and told her everything I knew about staying away from drooling, horny boys. Thanks to one opportune pucker floating by one night, she got to hear about 4 or 5 of my words. Her eyes fluttered open, glanced around like a frightened scavenger dog, and then drifted off back to sleep. Shortly after the girls turned 15, their brother could no longer control himself. He raped Bella first, and I can't remember wanting to harm a living human being so badly in my life, or my death. He left her in a broken heap in the woods, and then he went and found his other sister to do the same to her. And nobody did anything. The girls told their parents, and they barely batted an eye. I continued to stay by Bella's side. It hurt to see how the trauma had changed her, but I didn't know what else to do with myself. Her sleep wasn't sound no more. She would beg someone to stop what they were doing. Sometimes she woke up screaming and crying. Her brother would come in and tell her to be quiet unless she wanted it again. She would panic, but direct her screams into her pillow. He walked away smiling each time. And if I still had blood, it would be boiling. Her night terrors turned into sleepwalks. And that's when I noticed something. There was a pucker embedded in the left side of her head. It looked like someone was pulling the skin of her head inward, and it was sinking into a great inner vacuum. She looked around with empty eyes. "Bella, can you hear me?" I tried. She slowly turned to me, slack-jawed. "You can hear me." She nodded. "You can see me?" She began to nod. Then her eyes fluttered, and she screamed. The pucker disappeared from her head, and she stared at where I was standing. "Bella?" I said again. Nothing. She turned her head this way and that and ran out of the room. I was thrilled. She had seen me and heard me. And it wasn't the last time. Whenever she went sleepwalking, there was that pucker on the side of her head, and I tried to present myself in a way that wouldn't get her screaming. I failed each time. Whatever Casper's secret was to being a friendly ghost, it went over my head. Then, her brother assaulted her and her sister again. She had a pucker in the back of her head after that. Throughout the day, it would appear for a few seconds and disappear for several hours. I reached out to her even more, but she was as terrified of me as ever. I sat beside her one night in despair as she got out of bed for another sleepwalk. "Too bad you can't burn this place down with them all locked inside," I said. Her empty line of sight swept over me and she staggered out of the room. I got lost in my thoughts, and the sound of a yell and shattering glass broke my concentration. Surely your brother wasn't going to assault her in the house. I went downstairs to find that she had taken the family's large oil lamp and knocked it off the table. It was usually a nightlight, but this time it wasn't lit. Only the cover had broken. The reservoir of oil was intact. The family rushed downstairs, cleaned up the glass, chastised their daughter, and they all went back to bed. I stood and stared at the floor where the lamp had fallen. She'd not only heard me, she had acted on what I said. Martin's assaults on Bella became a regular part of her life. Even with dividing his energy between both his sisters, he was still on her often, and the puckers riddled her body, blinking in and out of existence like spiritual bullet holes. The more puckers she had, the harder it was for her to wake up from a sleepwalk. She also became listless and had all but completely stopped talking. But she also began responding to detailed suggestions. I could get her to do a set number of laps around the living area. I could get her to retrieve specific items in a specific order. I had a power over her that I would have used to extremes when I was freshly dead. But by then, she was my daughter, and I had no idea what to do with my ability to program her. One night, like any other, I sat beside her bed as she went to sleep. The ambient moonlight washed out just enough of her harsh features that she almost looked pretty. I gazed at her until she opened her eyes and looked right into mine. This made me jump. "You've been in my home for a very long time," she said. "You and your family sacrificed me and ate me. The least you could do is let me stay with you," I said. I couldn't remember if she had been born before or after I was murdered. It didn't matter. "Ma and Pa told me that the outsiders we eat aren't any smarter than pigs." "I talk pretty good for a pig ghost, don't I?" "Why are you always following me around? You've scared me so bad, and now I see you all the time. I've tried pretending I don't see you, but you're everywhere I go." "I can't leave this place. Plus, too, I never had kids. I guess I kind of fell in love with you." Her pupils flared. "Marty, too?" "Oh, hell no. Not Martin. Not at all. It kills me all over again to see him come near you. I mean that so much, Bella. And I didn't think it possible, but I started to blubber ghost tears." She got misty-eyed also. "You want to be free?" "Of course I want to be free, but I can't. Besides, I don't want to leave you now." "Well, I want to be free, and I'm gonna be."
"You gonna run away?"
She didn't answer. She just pulled her dirty blankets around her and rolled over. I haunted her really hard after that, pestering her with questions and begging her not to do anything stupid. My mind flew in all directions with paranoia. I didn't know if she was going to run away or kill herself or what. I could tell she heard me and saw me plain as day, but she wouldn't pay me no mind. I finally gave up and went off to be by myself. It wasn't like when I was alive and I could just go to bed to get away from what was on my mind. No, it was a constant state of dread. So I folded up and went to the church. I stood next to that awful altar where it had all started. I could feel the evil radiating off of it like heat. I got that feeling throughout the place, but it was strongest at the altar. I couldn't tell what was so special about it. It was wooden, covered with bloody hay. I got lost in thought, and I watched the daylight blink in and out through the stained glass as days rolled on. I was interrupted by the congregation coming in for another slaughter. They dragged the poor fool to the altar, bound and gagged. The pews filled up, and the high priest came front and center with that knife and that damned chalice. I scanned the crowd for Bella. I found her, and I swear she was looking right at me. The entire throng got worked up, feeding on the priest's bellows and howls, which they echoed back to him. All except for Bella. When my eyes fell on her again, she was smiling at me. She got up and slipped out of the church at a peak moment when nobody would notice. The priest made the kill. The chalice filled, he took a mouthful of the warm blood and spat it upon his flock. Then, things fell apart quick. The round, stained glass window at the peak of the wall and the roof behind the altar shattered. Something heavy crashed against the floor and erupted into flames. The church was mostly wood, and the fire fell in love with it. In the flash of confusion and panic, the flames suddenly rushed across tracks of hidden flammables to reservoirs of oil and other combustibles beneath the pews. The explosions were impressive. A few pews were launched whirling into the air, crushing and swatting parishioners. As soon as I remembered that I was dead and flame retardant, I passed through the walls of the church to look for Bella. That girl, I swear. I saw that all the doors had been barricaded from the outside. There were brackets for holding heavy lintels that hadn't been there the day before, and nobody noticed until it was too late and the lintels were in place. The church burned down, with everyone locked inside. I felt the change when the fire had kindled on the altar. Eric appeared beside me, and we exchanged the same look. "Your daughter's work?" he said. "Yep, sure is. I'm proud of her." "Me too." We were so caught up in watching the church burn that we were both startled by the sound of the trumpet that came from the sky. Me and Eric exchanged looks again. "Oh man, this just keeps getting better and better. Come on, let's go," he said. "I need to find Bella first." "No, you don't. You might not get a second invitation. Now let's go." I watched Eric buoy up toward the sky. He was right. If she had survived the journey out of her old home, then I would see her eventually. Hopefully. She was still innocent in the whole mess, in my opinion. "I'm ready, Lord," I said, and the most wonderful warmth I had ever felt wrapped around me. You've been listening to I Haunted a Cult That Sacrificed Me by Richard Morgan. Richard lives in the Midwest, Riverton, Illinois, very much small-town USA. What better place for writing horror? His crew consists of three cats, two kids, and his wife. He was a cake decorator before he took up writing full-time. Don't worry, none of those cakes were poisoned. He produces his own horror storytelling podcast, Marsh Lights, which can be heard on Spotify and most of the places you get your podcasts. You can keep up with him and his antics at richardmorganwrites.com. Next, to close things out tonight, here's Really Bad Dreams by Heath Pfaff. Brent was killed by a slice of toast fired at high velocity from an evil, sentient toaster. It blasted a hole right through his chest and took a huge piece out of the wall behind him. We didn't know what was happening at that point, but you really didn't need to know more than the fact that something terrible was happening. It was several hours later, as me and a group of friends were huddled in the bomb shelter under Dave's garage, that we picked up the first reports of what was going on while huddled in the dark around a wind-up radio. The news was calling them the spiral meteors, giant building-sized rocks whistling down from space to bury themselves into the ground like drill bits from the stars. They were pointed at both ends and twisted like a Twizzler, but sharper at the end. They were purple, like the kind of purple you'd see in a piece of psychedelic art, and everyone had a theory about what they were. My friends were arguing as to whether they were alien ships or some form of weapon fired from the other side of the world. The news wasn't saying where they had all touched down, only that there were 50 of them across the country and that they should be avoided. There were evacuations in effect, but for us, it was too late for that. One had drilled its way into that cheap French grocery store with all the great prices on brands you've never heard of, the one just down the street from my apartment. I loved those knockoff pizza rolls of theirs, but there wasn't much hope of me getting them again anytime soon. It was like the damned meteor, or spaceship, or whatever, had been dead set on ruining my day in a glorious fashion. If they were aliens, the most bargain basement of all grocers seemed like a poor choice of tactical targets, unless they knew how detrimental the pizza roll issue would be to human morale. Crushed grocery store aside, it was that weird pink mist that came out of the thing that was the real problem. I didn't even have to touch you to be trouble. I wasn't sure what set it off, but once it had you, things went bad real quick. It could see inside your head, and whatever terrible shit haunted your nightmares, that was the stuff it was going to squirt into reality. It was like some kind of 3D printer from hell, assuming hell was space, and the print material was pink mist. "Does anyone mind if I smoke?" someone asked, and the reply was a quick and surprisingly vehement resonance of the word no in varying levels of outrage. To be fair, we were in a small place, and there were at least 15 of us. I couldn't move without nudging into someone. "No one smokes," Dave declared, setting the rules since he was the one who owned this hole in the ground we were all stuffed in. Originally, it had been one of those pits for working on your car, but he dug it out a little more and installed a few benches and a shelf full of non-perishable food that I thought was probably less non-perishable than he believed. I wouldn't have wanted to try eating the canned meat products he had stacked all around us. We were all crammed into the main room of the shelter. There was another small room off to one side that was really just a doored-off stairway out of the pit with a hatch at the top that was made of some screwed-together layers of plywood. For about the 10th time since I'd arrived, I was questioning my choice to come here over just about anywhere else. I had to admit, in the aftermath of Brent's death, I hadn't been thinking very clearly. Brent was my roommate, and I was trying to figure out how I was going to pay his portion of the rent now that he was dead. I was still trying to figure this out when an Easter bunny came tearing past me with a knife. It was chasing a woman running away in bright yellow Crocs, but when it saw me, it turned and charged after me. I escaped, but not before I'd seen just too much. Way too much. I spent a great deal of time running, and before I knew it, I was at Dave's place with a bunch of other people. The general thought was, hey, doesn't Dave have a bomb shelter? None of us had actually seen it, and now that we were all crammed inside of it, I was sure that I wasn't the only one regretting this choice. Can I vape? Someone else asked, and there was a moment where everyone was quiet, as though thinking this through. I guess, Dave finally said, breaking the silence.
Oh, that is just not fair, Smoker snapped. He can vape, but I can't smoke? What kind of shit is this?
The smell of oranges and cotton candy filled the air, and the blue light of a vape pen lit up someone's face for a moment. I wasn't sure who that was. I knew some of the people, but not all of them. This was like a really shitty high school party, where the person's parents are gone for the night, but you still can't do anything because the kid who invited everyone is afraid of his folks finding out.
No one wants to breathe in your smoke, someone snapped, and then everyone else complained about the vape smell,
and I thought about leaving this dark hole in the ground and going upstairs to die. Eventually, things got quiet again, but I was certain it had taken a significant portion of forever.
How long will we need to stay down here?
Brian's voice spoke up from somewhere pretty close to where I was. Brian was probably late for a workout. Fortunately, he'd gotten over ending every sentence with the word bro, because that had been the worst.
At least until, Dave started speaking,
but his voice was cut off by the sound of someone trying to turn over a pull motor. What the hell is that? Oh, that was my voice. It was a good question. Do you have a weed eater down here? Brian asked.
What? No. Why would I have a weed eater in a bomb shelter? There are no weeds down here.
Dave seemed indignant, and then the engine pulled over again, and this time it did so successfully. Screaming followed a moment later, along with a terrible, splattering, squelching noise that put me in mind of someone throwing spaghetti and meatballs at a wall as hard as they could. The crowd surged towards the door, taking me with it. It was chaos, and I had no idea what was happening in the dark. But as the door was pushed open, I caught sight of a guy I didn't know holding a cigarette in one hand and holding the plywood hatch open in the other so he could blow the smoke out. Smoker had screwed us all over. Damn. Or maybe I should have thanked him for getting us out of that hole. No, people were dying. Screw that guy.
What's going on? I just wanted to... Ah, it's Dr. Chainsaw!
Smoker screamed, not finishing his first thought. I turned to look behind me, even as I kept moving out of the basement, and that's when I saw Dr. Chainsaw. It was an apt name. The man was dressed in a doctor's coat, and he had a chainsaw hand. If I had to picture what Dr. Chainsaw might look like, this is what I would have pictured. He even had one of those stupid old-timey reflectors on his head and a stethoscope around his neck. Maybe it was to check and make sure he'd properly killed you with his chainsaw? I was fairly certain that was a violation of his Hippocratic Oath, but then maybe he wasn't that kind of doctor. An unattached head sailed by my still-attached one, and I prioritized running over thinking. Our group of now bloodied basement skulkers spilled out onto the streets like a horde of the undead. I might have found this comparison to be amusing, considering how close we were to becoming the dead, but again, I was still prioritizing running. There is a certain level of panic you can reach where you do a thing with no forethought anywhere in your head. Sure, I was running, but where was I running to? Who was I running with? Did I have a plan? These and many other clever questions were getting no answers. I might have kept running until I collapsed from exhaustion had I not tripped over a curb, which were just too damn high in this neighborhood, and fallen directly into the corpse of a naked man. There was a javelin sticking out of his back, and attached to it was a note that read, "Jacob Riley is hereby suspended until further notice for going to school with no clothes on." Not a great way to go. I clambered back to my feet and stood up in time to see my grandmother walking down the street in my direction. I knew this was bad news since she had been dead for 5 years, and I was only too familiar with this dream. She had a bottle of skin cream in one hand.
Chubby cheeks! Oh no, not that part too. Gram-Gram needs some help with her lotion. Oh, Grams, I can't. You're dead, and I just...
Why was I talking to her? I knew what this was. I wasn't sure how it was going to try and kill me yet, but I knew it would. That's what these things did.
Dead? Dead?
Grams looked upset at this.
I'm dead because my little chubby cheeks wouldn't put the gods-be-damned lotion on my shoulders. You killed me, you little fucker. You killed me.
Graham's jaw popped out of socket as she said this last thing, and her mouth gaped open. The arm not holding the lotion bottle snapped backward at the elbow, and the broken bone folded out of the skin like a switchblade knife. This was new. I didn't have a great imagination, so all of this was original content brought to me by the pink horror mist. I was still standing there like an idiot who really wanted to die, and that's probably exactly what I would have done if Brian hadn't come charging out of nowhere, wielding a shovel like the sword Excalibur, and decapitated my grandmother directly in front of me. I let out a horrified scream.
"I saved you," Brian proclaimed.
"You killed Gram-Gram!"
I looked at him in shock, and then back to the headless body that was still standing in front of me. Long, ropey worms were crawling up out of the neck stump, and the body was starting to twitch and shudder.
Oh no!
Quick, kill Gram-Gram again! I shouted, pointing at the new horror show developing in front of us. Brian was on this. He'd always liked to show off how much he could bench press, and frankly, it was something I hated about him. But as he hacked my grandmother apart with that shovel, I couldn't help but appreciate the hard work he'd put into himself. I told myself that I owed him an apology, if we survived this horrifying apocalypse. A few minutes later, Brian was done, and so was Graham. He marched over to me, covered in a fine sheen of sweat and blood.
"I've got a plan," he announced, and started walking.
And I was so happy to hear it that I fell in with him automatically. I hadn't had a clear thought since any of this had begun, and I was ready for a plan.
"All right, what is it?" I pressed, eager to get off the streets and find somewhere safe to be. "We're going to the Winchester," he announced.
I frowned. Did he really just say that? I had to check. Now isn't really the best time for movie references, Brian.
"What? Oh, no, the Winchester, my rifle. It's in my garage. It has to work better than this shovel."
He held up the slightly bent tool. The shovel worked fine on Graham, and I'm not sure that one gun is going to make much of a difference right now. I looked ahead down the street in the direction we were traveling. That was the way to Brian's house, and it was also where the pink fog was the thickest. The screams coming from ahead of us were making me second-guess this whole business.
"I just feel better with a gun in my hands, you know?"
Brian clenched his empty hand as if imagining a gun there. I shook my head. I didn't really imagine anything would make me feel better at that moment. I wasn't really offering any sort of counterplan, though, so I reached into my brain and pulled out the first thing that I could get a hold of.
"Let's go to the mall."
I tossed this awful idea out like it was a viable choice.
"The mall? Is that a movie reference?"
Brian sounded as skeptical as he probably should have been.
"I saw both versions of that movie, and neither one ended well. Do you remember that zombie baby? That was so messed up."
It was. But this isn't a zombie situation," I pointed out.
"I just killed your dead grandma with a shovel. This is definitely a zombie situation."
Brian had found a hill to die on. I sighed. This wasn't getting us anywhere. "I think it's aliens. The giant spiral things are definitely spaceships."
"Zombies via aliens?"
Brian took a step back down the hill.
"What about Dr. Chainsaw in the basement?"
I was going to bring up the toaster that had killed Brent, but Brian had missed that one.
"Dr. Chainsaw is a stupid name. Where did that mess even come from? He almost cut my face off before I found the shovel."
Brian had found something new to center on, and I had just once more realized we were still walking towards the pink mist.
"I think the smoking guy made him up. He seemed to recognize him," I offered quickly. "Hey, Brian, the pink shit's getting kind of thick here. Maybe we should go back?"
"We're almost there. Look, that's my house."
He pointed to pink fluff that I couldn't see through.
"I'll just zip into the garage, grab old Blasty, and we'll head back the other way, though nothing has attacked us in like minutes, so I feel like maybe the pink stuff is safer than the fringes where we were before."
"Fine, I'll wait here. Go get your gun and then we'll start moving again," I said, deciding that going any further into the Valentine's Day horror cloud was not something I was willing to do.
Brian gave me an exasperated look.
Okay, I'll be right back."
He slipped off into the fog, and I held my place. I turned to look back the way we'd come and discovered that it was all pink that way as well. That meant that we were actually in the mist now, and the perception that we were still moving into it was an illusion of density.
"Great," I muttered quietly under my breath. I found myself pacing in a small circle so I could keep watch in every direction at once.
I was getting so good at my circle that I almost entirely missed the strange figure of a woman standing down the road from me. She was at the edge of the mist, just a dark shape on a pink background, like some kind of weird greeting card. If I could flip the whole scene over, I was sure there was a logo to be found.
"Please, if you're a monster, could you just not right now?"
It was time for a new strategy.
"I'm all filled up on terror for the moment. I need, like, maybe
3 or 4 hours. Come back then, and I promise, promise, that I'll have some more for you.
Begging seemed worth a try.
The woman then did something that most women don't do. She twisted her torso around at the waist to an impossible degree, and then bent down to the ground like an animal on all fours, except her elbows and knees were bent all backwards, and they seemed to stretch and get longer as she came running down the road towards me. Yeah, I remembered this nightmare. I shrieked in horror and ran in the direction that Brian had gone. I stumbled over the curb. That was a clear safety violation. Why hadn't anyone put in for a fix yet? And then across his driveway to the front door, which I slammed on with all my might. I could hear the meaty smack of the twisty girl getting closer, and I banged on the door again. In a moment of pure genius, I reached down and turned the handle, causing the magic portal to open in the way of the ancients, via hinges, and allow me inside. I slammed my back against the other side of the door and forced it closed, throwing the deadbolt just as the twisty woman slammed into the door jamb. She hissed and scratched at the wood. Why couldn't I have had stupid nightmares about toasters or doctors with chainsaw arms? Why did I have to dream such awful, terrifying things like Gram-Gram and the Twisty Woman? At least being killed by a toaster monster would be interesting and not sound like it came out of a made-for-TV horror movie. Brian? I called quietly, looking for where he may have gone. I saw the shovel against the wall near the door. I grabbed it. I didn't trust indoors any more than outdoors. What was taking him so long anyway? I made my way out to the garage and saw that the rifle was sealed in a lockbox next to the workbench. I tried the door, but it didn't budge. Brian must have gone back inside for the key. But where was it? I began to search his house as quickly as I could. I briefly opened one door and saw stairs down to the basement. Then I closed that door. Nope. Sorry, if you're down there, Brian, then this is where we part ways. I went upstairs instead. I opened doors, wondering how Brian could afford such a nice place when he lived alone. I was just about to allow myself to get jealous when I opened Brian's bedroom door and stared in horror at what I was seeing. I would never erase the trauma of that sight from my mind. Its dead eyes turned on me, and I pulled the door closed and started back downstairs. The monster, that was an amalgamation of a blow-up doll and two vacuum pump enlargers, had apparently enlarged Brian to death and was still attempting to enlarge the bloody, tattered remains of Brian's meat flute. I would take that secret to the grave with me. You were a good man, Brian. You didn't deserve to go out like that. No one did. I went to the back window and noticed that there were strange, vine-like weeds coming up through the grass, and it looked like the pink mist was beginning to fade. The vines were about shin high, and I could actually see them wiggling as they grew upward. I didn't know what that was about, but as I pushed back outside, I made a point of avoiding them. I decided I would go to the mall. Brian hadn't liked the idea, but Brian had died horribly, so what weight did his opinion really carry now? It took me the better part of 2 hours to get to the mall, and it seemed that the further I walked, the less of that pink mist hung in the air. I had a brief run-in with an inside-out mountain lion, and it ate a few of my toes and part of my left foot. But after that, it was clear sailing the rest of the way to the mall. Unfortunately, blood loss and shock set in, and I took the opportunity of my arrival to pass out. When I came to, there were all kinds of people around talking, and I had clearly been moved somewhere else. There were radios and televisions on. I got up and found my toes, or lack of toes, had been bandaged. Standing felt absolutely terrible, but I wanted to know what was going on. "What's happening?" I asked one of the people milling around a TV. He looked at me, seeming surprised to see me standing.
"They're seed pods," he said. "The big spinning things are seed pods. Apparently they landed and spread their seeds all over, and then the pink stuff fertilized them, gets them growing.
It also has some kind of defense mechanism that turns your nightmares into reality.
They found all of this out while I was asleep? I asked, surprised.
You've been asleep for 2 days.
His clarification of the timeline made me realize why I felt so awful. I hated oversleeping.
So, what now? What are they doing about this? I'm not doing the last few days again.
I added the last in such a way that it might be construed as sarcasm, though I was dead serious.
Well, the old pods are dying, but the new ones are growing fast, getting big, and they think they're going to take off and move on,
he explained, and I felt a surge of relief.
That's great news.
I was more than done with them. The man offered an apologetic smile that I immediately hated seeing.
Yeah, except they might incinerate most of the surface of the planet when they go, and possibly powder the rest in more nightmare spores.
Ah, good.
I reached up and rubbed the bridge of my nose. I wish I'd died of shock.
Yeah, sorry about that,
the other offered, and he sounded sincere. That was Really Bad Dreams by Heath Pfaff. Heath Pfaff is a writer of horror, sci-fi, and fantasy fiction, living in a rural town in western New York. Outside of writing, he tinkers with electronics and computers.
Well, friends, that wraps things up for tonight. If you're still looking for some good absurdist humor, I have a film recommendation for you. Tammy and the T-Rex. But you need to be sure to watch the uncut version, sometimes called the gore cut. There are a few times in my life I've laughed harder at a marauding dinosaur. And, just to add a dash of extra surreality, it stars Denise Richards and Paul Walker. Well worth 90 minutes of your time. But alas, our time tonight is at an end. I'd like to extend my sincerest thanks to both Richard Morgan and Heath Pfaff for a couple of really oddball stories that I absolutely loved. And of course, to you all as well for joining me. I've got more Horror Hill bleeding out in the kill room right now, and it should be ready right around this same time next week. Until then, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted, narrated, scored, and finalized by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Additional music by Nikki McSorley. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at submissions@simplyscarypodcast.com to have your work considered for future production. Note that any writing utilizing artificial intelligence is ineligible. If you enjoyed tonight's episode, why not help us spread our dark presence online? You can follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media, and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. It helps us out a lot, and also keeps you up to date on new episodes. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend signing up to be a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. Head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com to get started. If you're looking for someone to narrate or handle audio production for your own personal project, I just so happen to know a guy. Email me at ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. That's ericpeabodyvoice@gmail.com. And we can talk details. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.